Pull up a chair. I want you to imagine standing on a beach in Oakland, California, in the last days of May 1928. There's a big blue three-engine monoplane out on the field, and if you could read the name painted on her nose, it would say Southern Cross. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar where we tell the stories that don't make it into the textbooks. Today we're going to fly the widest, loneliest ocean on this planet in an airplane with no radar, no autopilot worth the name, and no place to set down for 7,000 miles. Before we push the throttles up, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friend, that's the whole reason we're here. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the man behind this whole business was an Australian named Charles Kingsford Smith. Everybody called him Smithy. He'd flown in the Great War with the Royal Flying Corps, took a load of shrapnel in the foot over France, and came home the kind of pilot who couldn't stay on the ground. Barnstorming, airmail, joyrides over the Australian outback, he got it in his head that a man ought to be able to fly from America to Australia across the Pacific. And just about everybody with sense told him it couldn't be done. Here's the thing about the Pacific. It is not just big, it is a scale of empty that's hard to hold in your mind. From California to Australia, by the route they flew, you're talking about better than 7,000 miles of open water, broken up by a couple of specks of coral you had to hit dead on or die trying. The airplane was a Fokker F7. Trimotor, three Wright Whirlwind engines, the same breed of engine that carried Lindbergh to Paris the year before. High wing, welded steel tube fuselage, fabric skin. She'd started life as a polar exploration ship up in the Arctic, and Smithy bought her secondhand and stripped her out for the long haul. They filled her belly with fuel tanks until there was barely room for four men to sit, and it was four men, Smithy in the left seat, his fellow Australian Charles Ulm in the right, the co-pilot and the organizer, the fellow who kept the whole dream funded when the money ran dry, and two Americans who made the whole thing possible. Harry Lyon, the navigator, and James Warner, the radio operator. Remember those two names. A lot of the glory went to the pilots, the way it always does. But out over that ocean, it was Harry Lyon's pencil and James Warner's radio key that kept them alive. They lifted off from Oakland on the last day of May, first leg out to Hawaii. 27 hours over open water just to reach the first stepping stone. That's a long day at the office, before you've even gotten to the hard part. Now here's where it gets interesting. The second leg is the one that should have killed them, Hawaii to Suva in the Fiji Islands, better than 3,000 miles, the longest overwater hop anybody had ever attempted, no island in between, nothing. If a single one of those three engines quit, if the navigator's math was off by a couple of degrees, they'd come down in water that no ship would ever find. And the weather did not cooperate. Picture that cockpit, it's loud, the whirlwinds are hammering away, so loud the men can't hardly talk. They're passing notes back and forth on scraps of paper. It's cold, and then it's hot, and then they fly into the worst of it. A tropical front, black as a coal cellar, towering up higher than they can climb. Rain coming at them sideways, the airplane bucking and dropping in the turbulence, instruments spinning, and Smithy and Ulm wrestling that control wheel by hand hour after hour with no autopilot to spell them. They flew through the night blind. Just the glow of the engine exhaust and the faint green of the few instruments they had. Harry Lyon down in the belly working by dead reckoning and drift sights, figuring their position off the wind and the waves and the stars whenever the clouds broke long enough to catch one. And they were flying to a target the size of a couple of islands in an ocean that could have swallowed every continent on Earth and asked for more. 34 and a half hours on that leg. 34 hours in a shaking, freezing, roaring cockpit, hand-flying through storms. Betting your life on a man with a sextant. And when the sun came up and the clouds finally opened, there was Fiji. Dead ahead. Harry Lyon had threaded a needle 3,000 miles long. They set her down at Suva on a little sports field, so short they had to strip weight and shuffle her around to get airborne again. One more leg to go. Fiji to Brisbane, Australia. Another storm-battered run. Better than 1,700 miles, and this one had them so low on nerves and fuel that when they finally crossed the Australian coast, Smithy said later he could have gotten out and kissed the ground. June the 9th, 1928. The Southern Cross came down at Brisbane. Then on to Sydney, where a crowd of some 20, both a crowd they later reckoned at 25,000 people, mobbed the field to see them. 10 days elapsed, better than 80 hours in the air. The Pacific, the ocean everybody said couldn't be crossed, had been crossed. And let me tell you why it still matters, sitting here almost 100 years on. Everybody remembers Lindbergh going to Paris solo, and he earned every bit of that. But the Atlantic is a pond next to the Pacific. What Smithy and his crew did was longer, lonelier, and in some ways harder. And it took a team of four doing four different jobs perfectly, over and over, for hour after hour, with nothing under them but salt water. It was navigation and radio work and airmanship and raw endurance all braided together. Kingsford Smith kept flying, of course. Fellows like that always do. He flew the Pacific again, flew the Atlantic, flew England to Australia. And in 1935, out over the Andaman Sea at night, on a record attempt, he and his airplane went into the water and were never found. The ocean he spent his life beating got him in the end. He was 38, but the Southern Cross herself survived. She's preserved to this day in a memorial near the Brisbane airport. That same welded steel and fabric that hauled four men across the widest ocean on Earth. If you ever get to Queensland, go stand in front of her. She's smaller than you'd think. They always are. My thanks to the Australian Aviation Histories and the accounts left by the crew themselves for the details on this one. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com. Next time somebody tells you your flying dreams are too big, you think about four fellows in a fabric airplane pointing the nose out over the Pacific with nothing but a sextant and their nerve. Blue skies, and I'll see you next time.